All right. Everybody at MPG, please help me to welcome Laura from Johnson City, Texas tonight. Thanks, Laura, for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I was going to tell you that there might be a dog in the background, but and I was really worried about it, but now I feel fine about it. I'm not worried at all. My name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm delighted to be with you guys this evening. Truly, by the grace of God, I've been sober since April the 6th of 1987, and I'm really grateful about that. I love getting asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in any form or fashion. I prefer mopping and making coffee. Sometimes God asks me to talk. So here we are. I was taught to always say yes, and that especially since, I mean, it's always beneficial to say yes in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's saved my life a number of times, but especially since Zoom, I don't really even have the words to tell you how enriched my sobriety has been by just saying yes. They say, hey, there's this meeting in Spain. Great, I'll go. Hey, there's a meeting in Jerusalem. Cool, I'm in, right? And the people that I've met, and so, you know, great, there's a meeting in Connecticut. Here I am. So when Levy called and talked to me about doing this on step one and for the hour, I think that the best thing I can do is give you a little bit of history about myself and where I come from in my drinking, my alcoholism. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I had a drinking problem. And if I quit drinking, it would get better. And I quit drinking, and it did not get better. It got exponentially worse for a good little minute before I became a student of the Big Book and understood exactly what was wrong with me. So hopefully I'll be able to communicate some of that to you guys this evening. I grew up in Austin, Texas, in the Hill Country, and I'm Irish and Italian and Comanche Indian. So I was going to be drinking. So what we had in my family were drinkers and watchers. And the drinkers drank alcoholically, and the watchers watched like untreated Al-Anons. And so we didn't really have any normal drinking. We didn't have any, we didn't really even have any heavy drinkers in my family. The people who were drinking in my family were alcoholics, and I loved it. I loved everything about it. They were loud and they were funny, and we had huge meals. I come from a huge extended family that I adore, and today they love me back. And there was a period of time where that was not true, but it is now. And we, you know, drinking was just a part of. The alcohol was just a part of our daily lives. I lived in Austin in the, I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, and there was this music, live music movement going on, and Willie Nelson and the Eagles were started there, and you know, and so they would take us with them, my folks, when they went out to listen to music. And so there was this group of couples, and all the couples had kids, and they would go in with eight kids and come, you know, they'd do the head count on the way out, make sure they had eight kids. Might have been a different eight kids, but they went in with eight and came out with eight. And we just sat under the table in the bars and listened to music and watched our parents dance and drink. And every once in a while, somebody would reach up on top of the table and take a drink down, and we'd all kind of take a sip off of it, you know. And so, but what I can tell you about me is that I was never, prior to working the 12 steps as they're outlined in the book, I was never comfortable anywhere doing anything, with anybody. And when I was about 6 years old, my mom decided, my little untreated Al-Anon mom decided that I needed to be in Girl Scouts. Now, I have to tell you, before I was 6 years old, we had identified that I had a pretty significant personality problem. Well, they had identified it. I was sure they were the problem. They were sure I was the problem. Anyway, so by the time I got to be six, you know, we're going to do Girl Scouts. I don't even like people. Like, I'm six. I don't want to affiliate with anybody but my dog, right? Like, I like to read and listen to music and hang out with the dog. Like, humans are too much for me. So we're going to go do Girl Scouts. My mother pulls up to this little annex by the church, and she says, go in that door right there, and I'm going to drop you off, and I'm going to park, and then I'll come in. And she dropped me off, and I left. And I walked about 2.5 miles up the road to a friend's house. I broke into the friend's house. I got some tuna fish, a drink, and her dog. And I went and hid out in her pool house. I was 6. Now, I've got grandkids now, right? And I look at them and think, oh, my God, right? Like, what was wrong with me? Well, I can now I know what was wrong with me. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism, right? I had a spiritual malady. I could not make myself go in there. I didn't want to have any part of that. I was so uncomfortable. So, and I hear it said in Alcoholics Anonymous a lot that alcohol was the solution for what was wrong with me. That for me, alcohol was relief for what was wrong with me. The solution for what's wrong with me is the 12 steps as they're outlined in the book. But alcohol was relief, and I needed relief. I didn't start drinking when I was 6. It would have helped. But when I did start drinking, I was always drunk, right? It talks in the big book about more or less always insanely drunk, right? And that was me. If there were 4 of us and 6 beers, I didn't even start drinking. Why bother? Because here's the truth about me. The first drink always makes me thirsty. It does not have the same effect on some of my friends that I have now that are normal drinkers. I watch them drink. It's fascinating to watch them drink. You ever watched a normal drinker drink? They take a sip, they set it down, and they visit with people. They eat their meal, for God's sakes, then they'll take another sip. You know what I mean? They'll have like 7 or 8 bites of food. Then they think, oh, yeah, there's wine on the table. I'll have a glass of wine. This is not how I drink. If I'm drinking, who needs food? And so every drink that I took, the first drink made me thirsty. The second drink started to settle things down, but my happy spot was the third drink. The third drink is where my shoulders kind of dropped a little bit, and I got relief from that acute discomfort. Now, I didn't have the language for it before I got to you. I didn't know what it was before I got to you. What I can tell you now, because you gave me the language, is that I was always restless, irritable, and discontent, right? But I didn't know that then. What I knew was the only time that I didn't care about being restless, irritable, and discontent was when I was drinking. And very quickly, people started to talk to me about my drinking. My teachers, my friends, their parents, my parents, very quickly it became a problem. Because every time I drank, I got drunk and I blacked out. And I love blackouts. Don't get me wrong, right? My friends would come and say, do you know what you did last night? I'd say, no, and don't tell me, right? If you tell me, I'll have to apologize for that crap. I'm happy to just say, no, I have no idea what I did, right? I don't remember a lot. People are happy to fill it in for me. So what happened for me is that in 1985, my mother attended an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was doing their job. And my dad had gotten suspended from work because of his drinking. And one of his coworkers was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he called her. And he said, I heard that Bill might have some trouble with his drinking. Would you like to go to an AA meeting? And my mother thought that maybe he had a brain tumor, right? Like, we were not talking about drinking in my house, right? And we were all dying from untreated alcoholism. But we did not know what was wrong with us. We did not know what was happening in our home. So anyway, she went to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him that night, and then she joined Al-Anon in July the 24th of 1985. And August the 6th of 1985, my dad went to treatment. And all of a sudden, I'm drunk, and Alcoholics Anonymous is at my house. And you guys were horrible. You were all awake, and you were paying attention, and it was awful. And now my dad's no longer unconscious, drunk, passed out, and, you know, that's now he's awake. It was a real game changer for me. And so they said, you know, you can't behave like this and live here. So I didn't live there anymore. I just left. And I had a little job, and my boss said, you can't come to work drunk. You can't work here if you show up drunk. I don't work here anymore. And my friend said, you can't be around us, right? It's too much, right? Okay, go find another set of friends. And it was never in my mind about the drinking because the alcohol was the relief, right? So it's not the problem. Everybody else had a problem with my drinking. My drinking for me was the only good thing I had going. So I got to April the 4th of 19, and I was living on the streets, and I was hustling pool for a living, and I weighed about 200 pounds, and April the 4th of 1987 was a really, really, really bad night. I had a tendency to mouth off when I'm drunk. I have a tendency to mouth off when I'm sober. I really have a tendency to mouth off when I'm drunk. Now that I'm sober, I think about it before I mouth off. When I was drinking, I just mouthed off. And I said the wrong thing to the wrong person. And it was a bad night. And April the 5th was worse than that. And I had taken a tire tool to the side of my head. And I was in really, really rough shape. And I called a friend just to clean up. I just wanted to clean up. And my parents had gotten in touch with some of my friends and said, listen, if you see her or if you know where she is and if she wants help, we will help her. And so I went to this friend's and asked if I could clean up. She said yes. And what I remember is that I was in her bathroom sitting with my back up against the vanity. And I didn't mean it as a prayer at all. But what I said, it was more of a thought. What I said was, God, if this can't get better, just let it stop. And I wasn't saying like, hey, I want to quit drinking, because I didn't want to quit drinking. I wanted the consequences of my drinking to stop. I wanted to drink like I drink, right? The book says it's the great obsession that we will be able to control and enjoy. But the truth for me is that I want to drink like I drink and not pay consequences for it, right? I want everybody to be fine with me being loaded. I want to be one of those people that can just be completely obliterated all night long and get up in the morning and go to work. Except that when I'm obliterated, I don't want to go to work anymore, right? It doesn't work like that. So anyway, the next day they called and said, you know, if you want help. And I did not want help. I did not want to stop drinking. What I wanted was to sleep indoors and bathe and sleep. I was tired. I was so tired. And I was hurting. And so I agreed, right? But I didn't agree because I had seen you people, right? So there's no gray area for me about y'all. I had seen y'all, right? I did not want what you people had. I was convinced I didn't want what you people had. But what happened for me is I went to treatment, and then they sent me to a halfway house, and I was removed from my environment for 6 months. And I was 118 days sober, and all of a sudden I realized that I didn't want to go back and live like I had been living. For me, I had to get better before I could see how sick I had gotten. I had to live like a human being for a little while instead of an animal, right, and heal up a little bit before I could say, you know what, I don't want that. And so at 118 days sober, I made a decision. I had an honest desire. 118 days removed from alcohol, I had an honest desire to stop drinking. And I came back to Texas, and I started going to meetings. For me, right, they said, can you admit that you were powerless over alcohol? And my very first step was, yeah, like, isn't everybody? Because I had never been around anybody that was a normal drinker. My friends drank like I drank or didn't drink. My family, the people in my family, drank like I drank or they didn't drink. So when they said, can you admit that you're powerless over alcohol? I was like, are there people that aren't powerless over alcohol? Like, what the hell does that even mean? Sorry, pardon my language. What does that even mean? So we did Father Martin's Chalk Talks, and they explained the whole disease concept, and I may or may not have been paying attention, probably not, to most of that information. I came back to Austin, and I got very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to meetings every single day. I had service commitments. We had a 12-step, we had a detox room at the club that I attended, and we sat with wet drunks, and I miss being able to do that a lot. And so anyway, I did all of that. I was very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't work any steps, and I didn't crack the big book, and I found a hymn to make it better. If you've never had a hymn, you should get one. The spiritual growth that comes from having a hymn. Nothing like it. Nothing like it, let me tell you. So anyway, I got a hymn. It turns out hymn can't treat alcoholism. But we tried, you know, we tried. Complete and total insanity. And so anyway, I was about 4 years and 2 months away from my last drink, and I was in more pain than I had ever been in before. Even when I came to you in April of 87, and I went to a meeting on accident. I went to a meeting every day at 5:30. And so that day I accidentally ended up in a meeting at 5:30. If I had consciously thought about it, I might not have gone, but I did. So I ended up in a meeting and I raised my hand and I said, I can't do this. Whatever is wrong with me is not what's wrong with you, because you people quit drinking and you're happy. And I have quit drinking and I'm dying here. And there was one guy in the room that said, don't leave the meeting. And by God's grace, I didn't leave the meeting. And he visited with me after the meeting and he said, well, what he said was, you are a spoiled brat and you are vain and self-centered and you want someone else to be responsible for your recovery. That's what he said, which is, I thought, exceedingly rude. And he said, you've never cracked the big book and you don't even know what's wrong with you. And he was right. And so I made a deal with him that day, and it was June the 11th of 1991. It was 30 years ago this month. I made a deal with him that I would do everything it said to do in the first 164 pages of the book. And he said if I did that and I still felt as bad as I felt that day, that he would finance my drunk. I made him write it down. We used to have these fancy little white coffee napkins, ceramic coffee cups, and I made him write it down on a coffee napkin. I still have that napkin. And he wrote it down and signed it, and I made a contract with him that day, and I became a student of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it turns out I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I really didn't know what it meant to be powerless over alcohol, and I really didn't know what it meant to say that I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I didn't understand what was wrong with me at all. When I got here, I thought I had a drinking problem and that if I stopped drinking, it would all be better, and it was not. And so as I'm watching you in meetings and you guys have families and your things are being amended, right? And your kids are there, or you're employable and you're financially getting stable, and your relationships are improving. And I'm thinking, psh, I'm not having any of that, right? So I must not be like them, right? But you were treating your alcoholism and I was not treating mine. So I started attending a Tuesday night meeting, and for 45 minutes we listened to Joe and Charlie. And then we took a 15-minute break, and then we came back in and discussed for 30 minutes what had been shared. And I started attending 3 big book studies a week, and I got a sponsor and a real sponsor that knew what it said. In the first 100, I had had a sponsor that first 4 years, but I'm pretty sure she didn't know anything about the big book either. And if she ever shared it with me, I didn't hear it. And I had not seen any evidence of it since. So, anyway, so I started going to several big book studies, and I became a student of the text because I had signed this contract. I had agreed, and I didn't know really what I had agreed to do. And so we started looking at the doctor's opinion right away, right? And it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. How can you argue with that? I'm not drinking because I want a party. I'm not drinking because I want to hang out socially and just take it. I'm drinking because I want oblivion. My happy place is a dark corner and a fifth of tequila and no human contact, man. That's what I'm about, right? Like, get me there and let me live there without consequences. You have a different speaker, right? But that wouldn't work like that. So, right, I absolutely, the effect produced by alcohol. Right. And it says, until we can experience an entire psychic change, we are doomed to repeat this process over and over and over again. Right. I'm going to. Why? Why am I going to do that? Why would I continue to drink? It's so obvious to everyone else. Why would she continue to put herself through this when she knows? And that's the deal, right? You always hear in meetings about, they say, insanity is repeating the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Let me tell you something. I knew exactly what was coming. I was not surprised by the results of a drinking escapade. The insanity was, I knew it. I knew what I was going to do. I knew how it was going to go. I knew where I was going to end up. And I took that drink anyway, every time, every single time, right? That's powerless, right? That's powerless. Why am I doing that? So I have a disease that demands treatment. And I'm going to treat it with the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'm going to treat it with alcohol, or I'm going to treat it with a bullet. And a lot of people choose to do that. My dad did that after 7 years of sobriety. My dad took himself out because he was so uncomfortable, right? Mostly because he was trying to treat a chemical imbalance with a spiritual solution. That doesn't work either. Doesn't work to treat a spiritual solution with a chemical solution, turns out. Neither one of those things work very well. But so I have a disease that demands treatment. And what does that look like? It looks like I can't be present. I can't breathe comfortably. My whole mind is occupied with how I look and what you think about how I look and what's going to happen next. And are you going to say this? And then how will I react to what you say? And then how do I get what I think I need? You know, I mean, it's just the noise in my head, right? And the knot in my gut. And I'm so separate from, right? And my alcoholism has one job, and that is to separate me from fill in the blank. My family, my kids, Alcoholics Anonymous, God, right? My alcoholism, that's all it needs. It just wants to get me separate. If my alcoholism can get me alone in a corner, it picks up the megaphone and it starts talking to me, right? And it never starts with, you know what we ought to do? We ought to steal a bunch of money, go get all the booze we can, and just burn the planet to the ground, right? It never, because who would go for that? Right? My alcoholism starts with, can you believe they didn't say thank you? That's what it sounds like, right? And then I think, oh, yeah, they didn't say thank you. You know, they don't appreciate me. Maybe I just won't go back to that meeting. Nobody at that meeting appreciates what I contribute. That's my alcoholism, right? My alcoholism is talking to me about how unappreciated I am. Right? And how I don't really need to go back to that. You know, you're really tired. It's been a long day. You should put your feet up. That's my alcoholism. Right? But I didn't know that. I did not know that. What I know today is that my alcoholism has a stronger survival instinct than even I do. And so every day, I'm getting there. I'm getting to step one, I swear. Every day, right, I have to treat that disease. Every day, every morning, I wake up with untreated alcoholism, and there's something that's going to happen right then, right? I'm going to follow the directions as they're outlined in the text, or my alcoholism's going to have the day. And there isn't another choice for an alcoholic of my type, right? I don't know about, there's lots of other people that do it lots of other ways, right? But tonight, I'm what you got, right? And for me, right when I wake up, the choice is I'm going to follow the directions as they're outlined in the text, or alcoholism's going to have the day, right? And my alcoholism is patient, and it will wait, right? It will wait for me to be too busy. It will wait for me to answer the phone before I pray, right? That sudden phone call, right? It's patient. So every day I have to have a first step experience. Every single day I have to have a first step experience in order for me to treat my alcoholism. And what that looks like is when I wake up, I'm powerless over alcohol. Now that's true. And it's as true today as it was the day that I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? After 34 years, what I say is I'm powerless, period. Because as we study the text, right, it says in step 12, the only power we get back is the power to help others, Right. That's the only time it ever gives us back any power, which is kind of disappointing, but that's the deal, right? The only power I'm given back in Alcoholics Anonymous is the power to help others. It says, I think it's on page 130, but I'm not positive about that, but it's in that section of the book, and it talks about why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others, right? But that's it. So I'm powerless. And when I forget that, my life becomes unmanageable. Why? Well, if I know that I'm powerless, I ask for help. It's when I forget that I'm powerless, and all of a sudden I think, I got this. I'm good. Right? And I hit the ground, and I lived that way. And I had a lot of days since I've been sober where I've approached the day that way, right? I'm running late for work. I got a house full of kids. We can't get dressed. We can't, blah, 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 chaos and disorder, right? And I did not make treating my disease my priority, right? And so what I made a priority was getting these little monsters dressed and fed and to school, right? And so that's my objective for the morning. You know what happens? About 20 minutes after I drop them off from school, I am unfit for human interaction, right? I'm a maniac, just like I was with 4 years, because I didn't start my day powerless. My sponsor, God rest his soul, I had a sponsor for 22 years. He passed last October. And he would say to me, Laura, you're powerless over those kids. And I think that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my whole life. I gave birth to these children. I am in charge of these children. I am not powerless over these children. By God, they will behave, right? And my oldest daughter, she was tough. My oldest child was about 13, and I called him and said, oh, my God, I'm powerless over her. And he laughed at me, you know. So my alcoholism, the nature of my alcoholism is restless, irritable, and discontent. And maybe I can stay there for a little bit. And maybe I can just be an unpleasant person to be around. Right? And maybe I can even come to meetings like that and be of service. I've seen a lot of people being of service, restless, irritable, and discontent. Right? Maybe I can do that. But eventually what's going to happen is I'm going to become so uncomfortable, I'm going to need some relief. And alcohol was always relief for what was wrong with me. And so I have to identify that I'm seeking the relief, right? And that's really what recovery has looked like for me around step one. Early on, right? It says in the book, lack of power was our dilemma, right? It's a dilemma. You know what a dilemma is? A problem with no acceptable solution, right? Because I don't like being powerless, and I don't like having to ask for help, right? Neither one of these things work for me. What is option C, right? Is there a door number three, please, right? There's not. There's not. And so in the book page 34, it says, as we look back, we feel we've gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he's entered this dangerous area, right, let him try leaving liquor alone for a year. Who wants to do that, right? If he is a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant chance of success. Right? And then the next paragraph, it says, we are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Right? And so this idea that I can choose to be, today I choose to be sober. The text is telling me I've lost the power to choose whether I get to be sober or not. What I get to choose is to follow the directions in the book or not. I don't get to choose to keep me sober. If I could keep me sober, I wouldn't be here. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't still be coming to meetings. Well, maybe I would. I love you guys, right? Maybe I still would. But probably I never would have stuck around long enough to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. If I could just make a decision to stop drinking, do you know what that makes me? A hard drinker. That's as the definition in the big book. It says if a sufficient reason presents itself, a heavy drinker can stop or moderate or stop altogether. Right? So if I can choose not to drink today, that's amazing. Right? And not alcoholism. Right? It's heavy drinking. I have some cousins who are heavy drinkers, it turns out. I suspected they were alcoholics for quite a while, because it certainly looks like they are, but they're not. They drink like I drink until 1 o'clock in the morning, and they get up at 6, and they get their kids ready, and they take them to swim practice, and they pay their bills, and they stay married, and they've had the same jobs forever. So I don't know. It doesn't even make any sense to me. Anyway, it tells me that the experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe, this is how we can be even more helpful in determining whether someone is alcoholic or not. We shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obviously, this is the crux of the problem. Right? What's the crux of the problem is my mental state before I take a drink. Right? And when I read the doctor's opinion and it talks about restless, irritable, and discontent, that's sober. That's me without a drink in my system. And then I drink. Right? I'm going to get so uncomfortable, I'm going to demand relief. Right? So if I flip over to page 45, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. I looked up the word sufficient a number of years ago. And the definition of sufficient is adequate for the purpose. So I have a code of morals. I have a better philosophy of life. Maybe I've got a strong religious background. Maybe I have a really strong belief in God. It's not sufficient for the purpose of producing recovery from alcoholism. Right? It's good, but it's not sufficient for what we're trying to do here, which is treat alcoholism. Right? We found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral, willpower. We could wish to be philosophically comforted, willpower. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. I have the will, but I haven't tapped into the power. Right? That's powerless. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. There it is again. Right? They're not adequate for the purpose. They failed utterly. Lack of power is our dilemma. We have to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. So for me, right, I had to concede that alcohol was relief. As long as I was sort of this boy whistling in the dark saying, not thirsty, don't miss it, everything's great, I couldn't get better. Right? I had to be honest and say, I'm thirsty. I miss it. I love alcohol. I loved drinking. I loved everything about drinking, right? And I can't imagine a life without alcohol. I had to tell the truth about that before I could really start to get better. Right? As long as I sat in meetings and said, so grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right? And I was a page 449 girl, mostly because it was the only thing I'd ever read in the big book. And so almost every meeting I'd say, acceptance is the answer. It was really obnoxious. It's a miracle they didn't throw me out. I had to tell the truth. And the truth was, I missed the relief. Right? I was thirsty. And what I needed was some way to get to a place where I was unthirsty, right? I needed some way to get to a place where I didn't need relief. And I could not fathom how that would ever happen because I had never experienced it before. So what you people were talking about sounded great, but I didn't know, right? So I needed to start listening to you guys talk about your alcoholism. Not your drinking, right, necessarily. Not the bankruptcies and the DUIs and the divorces and but the ism. I needed to hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous talk to me about the ism so that I could keep my chair. Right? I needed to hear, and Don Pritz, who I followed around forever, said he had this phrase, and the first time he ever said it, I just started to cry because I'd never heard anybody say it before, and it was like, oh my God, that's it. And he said, alcoholics suffer from excruciating loneliness. And I was like, that's how I feel, right? I didn't know that. I didn't know that, right? And then he says, an acute self-awareness. Yes. Yes. Right? I suffer from acute self-awareness. I'm always aware of how I'm doing. So I needed to be able to get relief. And my first step for me has to be telling the truth. The truth is I cannot fathom not having the relief of alcohol and being okay. Right? I can't. And that's for me, right? What happens next is I start to try and figure out how to manage getting relief. Right? And the unmanageable for me is not the chaos that has ensued, right? The unmanageable for me is that I know, right? I'm seeking relief here and it isn't going to work because it's not alcohol, right? My life is unmanageable. I'm going to get the him. I said the him earlier. I'm going to get him, right? I'm going to get enough money in the bank. And my kids are going to be well-behaved. I don't know if y'all have had well-behaved kids. I have zero experience with well-behaved children. I do not breed well-behaved children. I breed maniacs, right? I don't know. What I've had is a series of opportunities to learn about living sober and powerless. And what that looks like for me today is that I'm powerless, and when I forget that, my life becomes unmanageable. When I know that I'm powerless today, I say, God, please help me. I don't have any power here. I can't do anything about this, right? I'm going to go chop wood and carry water. You deal with this mess, right? And I get busy being a service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I let my higher power handle whatever the problem is. But if I don't, right, and I go, I got this. I'm good. Let me just get a bigger hammer. Right? I'm just going to get a bigger hammer and I'll fix it, right? Nope. So one of the best analogies I've ever heard is that my dad actually came up with it when early in his recovery, is that he had this image in his mind of his higher power driving a big red convertible Cadillac. And we have two choices. We can get in the passenger seat and enjoy the ride, or we can get tied to the bumper and dragged behind the Cadillac until we're willing to get in the passenger seat and enjoy the ride. But having the keys to the Cadillac is not one of our available options, right? And I'm that girl. I want the keys to the car, right? I don't want to be powerless. I don't want to say, I don't know, right? I want to say, I got it. I got this, right? And so for me today, it's like, am I willing to get in the passenger seat, right? Am I willing to just get in and enjoy the ride, right? One of the things that I know is that I wrote something down earlier. Let me see if I can find that note. Oh, once I have been, and this is my one of my things lately, but once I have been rendered abstinent, right, because that's what happened for me, is I was just rendered sober. I was separated from alcohol. It wasn't like I made a decision and said, I'm never going to pick up another drink. I was separated from alcohol, and the grace of God had the opportunity to come in. In order for that to happen, I think we have to have the gift of desperation. I think sobriety happens when the gift of desperation and the grace of God meet. In that moment, right, then we get sobriety. And if we can maintain that, we get to stay here. But it requires participation on our part. No spiritual life can happen without participation, right? I can't know everything it says in the first 164 pages of the book, not be taking action on it, and have a spiritual life. I can't go to all the meetings that we go to, right, sit next to the spiritual people and get it by osmosis, right? I have to be beaten into a state of submission. My sponsor actually really, really objected for years to the word surrender. He'd say, that word's not in the book. You know, I was defeated, right? And God bless him. And I understand his point, particularly around step one. Nobody ever talked me into believing I was powerless in any area of my life, particularly around alcohol. Nobody. The way I learned that I was powerless over alcohol was the members of Alcoholics Anonymous talking about their alcoholism. They talked about when they come and say, if you take another drink, we're going to take your kids. And you take another drink. Right? When I know that if I take this drink, I'm going to set aside all my values and I'm going to end up sleeping under that slide. Right? I know that. But I can't stand being me more than I don't want to sleep under that slide. More than I don't want to set aside my values, I want relief. Right? And I could hear you guys telling those stories. Right? I could hear you telling the truth about your alcoholism. Right? So the stories about, oh my God, I was in a car wreck and the car caught fire and we burned down the LA freeway and blah, 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 it was a cop chase. That's all great. It's very entertaining. But it doesn't save lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. What saves lives in Alcoholics Anonymous are the people who can stand up. And I have a few. There are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I can hear in my heart, right? I can hear them. And when they talk about their untreated alcoholism, my head nods off my shoulders, right? I'm like, me too. And so when I can talk to you about my untreated alcoholism, right, I give somebody who's new the opportunity to say, oh my God, that's me. Oh my God, maybe I do belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where Scott Redmond used to say, we catch alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's contagious in the meetings. You catch it through your ears, right? And that's the deal, right? I came and I listened to you guys talk about your untreated alcoholism and I caught it here. I was certainly not one of you before I got here. And so my job is to talk to the new man, and in any meeting, really, not even just to the new man, because there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous who haven't had a drink in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years or 25 years that are dying from untreated alcoholism because they think that drinking is the problem, right? They think going to meetings is going to treat what's wrong with them. Listen, I'm a huge fan of going to meetings, right? I'm all about it, but it's a piece, right? The treatment for what's wrong with my alcoholism. And actually, meetings is what happens after I treat my alcoholism. Then I'm going to be of service, right? And I love going to meetings. It was a safe place for me. And if I had not been going to a meeting every day, I might not have survived my untreated alcoholism. And you guys, I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I accidentally got what I needed, right? Not because I was seeking it, but just because I went to a meeting every day, right? So I'm not knocking meetings. The meetings are not designed to treat my alcoholism. The program that of recovery that treats my alcoholism is in the text. And even if I go to 90 big book meetings a week, right? And if I know all the definitions for all the words, right? And if I know all the history about all the people and who wrote this and who edited that and where it all came from, it's irrelevant if I'm not taking the action that is outlined to treat my alcoholism. I am still going to end up needing relief. The best example of that for me, we had a guy when I got sober, his name was John Burney, and on one weekend in June, he led a big book meet, a big book, June of 93, I guess, he led a big book weekend, and it was a whole weekend of a big book workshop, and that guy knew more about the text of Alcoholics Anonymous. He forgot more about the text in Alcoholics Anonymous than I will ever know, right? And he led this weekend, and it was wonderful and awesome. And Thursday, they found him dead in a hotel room with a bottle on the floor and a needle in his arm. And I was like, what? It blew my mind. I was, you know, 5 years sober at the time and 6 years sober, I guess, at the time. And I was devastated. And one of the old-timers came over to me and he said, what you know won't keep you sober. And I'll never forget it. right? He said, John knew more than most of us. And I was like, but what happened? He said, he didn't do it, Laura. And I was like, okay. And I just did, got it. Click, right? So I know today, right, that I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable unless I take the actions that are outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that simple, right? We lose people all the time. We lose people of faith. We lose people that are active. They look so active. They're so busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. We lost a lot of people when the pandemic hit, right? Because the meeting makers couldn't get to meetings, right? And thank God for Zoom, right? But we lost a lot of people. The other thing that's happened during the pandemic is a lot of people's recovery has been really rejuvenated. There were a lot of people that were dying from untreated alcoholism with some time, right? And their lives are enriched because of the meetings they've been able to attend online and the speakers they've been able to hear, right? I am now raising a four-year-old granddaughter. My oldest daughter's oldest child has been with me since the day she was born. This was not my plan. And if you're wondering whether you're powerless or not, I'd be happy to send her to your house for a few minutes. I will pay you to borrow her for a couple of days. She is in charge of my house. Anyway, and so, you know, I have challenges, life challenges, that I cannot travel, right? I have this child that I am the sole caregiver for, and I can't go to conferences, right? That was my big plan. And I guess I've got a couple of minutes left. Do I have a couple minutes left? Okay, so I'm going to tell you one more story about this first step experience. I had a plan. My best friend Diane and I got sober together. She came in a little bit after I did, and we'd been sober together the whole time. And she was the diplomatic one. I was the problem. And so she served at a group level, and then she served at a district level, and then she served at an area level because she's very well behaved in public, right? And she's very diplomatic. I go to a group conscience meeting. You guys would still probably ask me to leave. I got a big mouth. And it's not my niche, right? There's a nut for every bolt in Alcoholics Anonymous, and service at that level is just not my niche. And I'm grateful for the people that can do it. But anyway, Diane was one of those people. And then she got elected delegate, and she served on the committee for the literature committee for the fourth edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was in New York several times. She was very useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then she had a boy problem. She had him. And she didn't tell anybody about him. And she was busy being a delegate. Or a former delegate. And her image was very important to her in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had a secret. And then they called me. And they said, she's in pretty bad shape. You better come out here. We had ended up living in separate towns. Our plan had always been that we were going to get these kids raised. And then we were going to be those old-timer women who scare the newcomers. Right, we were going to go to all the conferences, and we were going to stay up late, and we were going to play poker. And because when I got sober, there was these three old women in Alcoholics Anonymous traveled all over Texas, and they chain smoked, carried their oxygen tanks behind them. They were all blue hairs. They've been sober. One of them got sober in 1944. I mean, they've been sober a long time, right? And they just, you know, you'd go up to them, you'd say, hi, Evelyn. And she'd say, what do you want? You know, with the cigarette hanging out of her mouth, you know, are you willing? You know, oh, God. And we were like, we're going to stay sober long enough to be like that. That's our plan, right? This is our retirement. We're going to get old. We're going to be cranky old timers. We're going to be able to say anything we want because we've been sober so long. Nobody can correct us. Anyway, so, you know. So Diane, they called me one day and said, you know, she's in pretty bad shape, and you better come out. And she was in West Texas. I was in Austin. And I got on a plane and went out there, and it had all, you know, blown up. And very shortly after that, she returned to drinking and pill and some other stuff, some harder drugs that I was not familiar with. She ended up in the hospital with COPD, and then she had a stroke, and she kept trying to go to meetings. She was a bag lady. She carried her oxygen tank. Her hair was stringy. Her clothes did not match. They were not clean. And she'd been a delegate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was horrible. That's the truth. The truth is it was a horrible, horrible thing for me to watch. But it was a remarkable lesson for me to learn. She was so, and she said to me one time, "Why are you so transparent?" She said, why do you just tell people what's going on with you? She was so mad at me at the end of her life because I was still sober. And she would call and she would say, "Will you come get me and take me to a meeting?" But she had become wet-brained. And I would say, "No, but I'll get a pizza and I'll come over and hang out." And I'd get a pizza and I'd go over and sit and listen to her talk to me about the Bible and whatever. I mean, every day was a new adventure with her. And then they finally called in January of 2017 and told me that she had died and she'd had another stroke and it had killed her. She'd been doing drugs again. And that's the reality of alcoholism. Her alcoholism was really talking to her about her reputation and her image in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so I don't have one, right? What you see with me is what you get, right? Mostly because I don't want her to be lost in vain. That's really the deal. I don't want what she suffered through to be for nothing. And so, it's warts and all. The other day I was doing a meeting, I was doing a talk like this on step 7, and that morning I had thrown a shoe at the 4-year-old, right? She threw it at me first, but I had just fallen and hurt my knee, and I was on crutches, and she wouldn't get dressed, and so the shoe landed on the counter, and I just picked it up and threw it back. Now I was on crutches, so I missed her by a mile. Thank God. And then she turned around and looked at me and she said, "Nona, you need time out." And I said, "You know what? You're right. I do." And I just put myself in my room and shut the door and started my day over again. Cause I'm powerless over that 4-year-old. So the point of all that is that my alcoholism is patient and it's sneaky. And even when I'm a delegate, even when I'm chairing meetings, even when I'm the coffee maker, even when I'm carrying newcomers to meetings, right? It can start to look like I'm doing all right, right? What I know to be true to my core is that if I have not followed the directions as they are outlined in the first 164 pages of the book, I am not treating my alcoholism. It is a three-legged triangle, right? And one of those legs is recovery. There is unity. There is service. But one of those legs is recovery. If I'm not taking my inventory, if I'm not having a first step experience when I wake up in the morning and a second step experience and a third step experience, right? If I'm not practicing 10 and 11, right? I'm missing one side of that triangle and everything is going to collapse, right? Everything is going to fall apart because I need all three things to be in place in order for me to be whole. And here's the deal. Right? I will say this and then I'm done. Here's the deal. I get up in the morning, I follow those directions, and I go throughout my day, and I don't need relief. I don't ever get thirsty. Right? I live in a complete state of unthirsty. Right? I live in a state of grace. God has created a transformation from the inside out in my life that allows me to be most of the time, like really most of the time, comfortable where I am with who I'm with, doing what I'm doing, and present and accounted for, right? But that happens as a result of me waking up in the morning and knowing I'm powerless, first thing, right? And then asking for help. And today I ask for help from a higher power that I have a really great relationship with, but I also ask for help from y'all regularly when I need it, right? I am sponsored. I have a tremendous fellowship of women and men around me that I can call, that we hold each other accountable, right? Nobody co-signs anybody's bad behavior in my crowd, right? Because we don't want to bury each other. Not because we're a bunch of badasses who think we know some stuff, because we've been to a lot of funerals. That's the truth. And we've agreed we don't want to bury each other to untreated alcoholism. And so we hold each other accountable. And we say you're powerless over that a lot. So I don't know if that's what, you know, you guys were looking for, but I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys this evening. And thanks for listening.